Well, congratulations to scientist Eric Lander. He was named today as one of the winners of the new Breakthrough Prize in Life Science, every winner getting $3 million, twice the Nobel, from a group of business leaders, including the founder of Google and Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, who want to make scientists who think big, take risks, and have made a significant impact on our lives into household names. Lander is on his way toward that. He was one of the leaders in the Human Genome Project, which mapped the human genetic code. He went on to found the Broad Institute here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. That's the research center, often described as a playground for scientists. He has his critics who say, where are the cures for cancer that were expected when huge amounts of research money were poured into the Genome Project? But when President Obama was asked who his favorite mathematician or scientist was, he named Eric for his work and for his ability to explain it. Eric does advise the president, and for years he has taught the Introduction to Biology course at MIT. Now, if you always wanted to go but couldn't, that class called The Secret of Life will be available free online to everyone starting March 5th through edX, the Harvard-MIT collaborative. We'll link you up at herenow.org for more information. Meanwhile, we wanted to know more about that and about Eric Lander's genetics work. He came to our studios last week, and we started with how, because of genetics work, biology has changed.
Biology has gone through this mind-blowing transformation. It's even changed in the last decade compared to when I first got involved in it. The cost of DNA sequencing has fallen 1 million-fold in that decade. Nothing I know has ever fallen 1 million-fold, and so it suddenly means biologists are out collecting information on cancers, on diabetes, on schizophrenia, and creating this amazing, you know, book of life out there.
You are correct. It's as if a tumbler on a lock got picked and bam, they just kept tumbling and tumbling and tumbling with all these discoveries. But you know there are people saying, well, wait a second, I thought you were going to have the cure for cancer, a month ago. So I want to ask you more about that. But so what are you going to teach in this course that for some of us was cells? What is it now because of what we know?
A century ago, right at the turn of the 20th century, we didn't understand how cells could carry out transformations, how they could digest your lunch. We didn't understand how heredity was transmitted. And the last century has been one of the most amazing intellectual unifications, figuring out how it is that biochemistry works, figuring out how it is that genetics works. And then in the middle of the 20th century, this unification to realize that they're really two sides of the same coin, that these genes that you study in heredity are the things that encode the proteins that carry out all the biochemistry in all your cells. And then what's happened since then, in the second part of the century, figuring out not just that in theory, but in practice, how to read out genes with DNA, with recombinant DNA, and then how to read out the entire human genome. So we've gone in 100 years from having no clue to almost the whole catalog. And for most people, because it's been happening during their lifetime, they say, well, I wasn't interested in biology in high school. I got to say, I hated biology in high school.
No, wait.
It was terrible.
Are you serious?
It was boring. It was memorizing stuff. So what I try to do in the course is talk about the principles.
Well, let's remind ourselves. DNA is the molecule that encodes instructions for what organisms, where an organism, inherit biologically. So your eye color, you know, how your ears look. A gene is a unit within that molecule. The genome is the map of all of that. Then there's DNA sequencing. Explain that a little bit more.
Your DNA, it's an instruction book. It's a very long instruction book with 3 billion letters. Genes are particular sentences there. They have instructions for particular things. And DNA sequencing is just plain learning how to read the book. For a long time, until actually pretty recently, we couldn't read even a single letter. Then it became possible to read some sentences here and there painfully. And then it's all just pouring out. You can read not just the book once, but everybody's book of DNA.
So apply this to the course. Just give me an example of what, just a more specific example of what somebody might see.
How it is do we even know that DNA is the hereditary material? How did people ever figure that out? We'll talk about that. And then we'll talk about when they figured it out, how did they figure out not just that it was the hereditary material, but how did it work? Crick and Watson in the middle of the century with this famous double helix that everybody sees. Why does that matter so much? Why is that double helix really the secret of life? And then how's the instructions encoded? It's a four-letter language. It sounds kind of boring, but I suppose, you know, your computer's just a two-letter language, ones and zeros, and yet you manage to get pretty good pictures and pretty great music, and I suppose this program's going out in ones and zeros also. Mm-hmm. So you can do an awful lot with a pretty small language. How does DNA do that? So now the questions become, for the years ahead, as we start comparing the DNAs, say, from 100 people who might have a skin cancer. Can we figure out, based on the changes that you see, what it is that drives a skin cancer? From 30,000 people who have schizophrenia, can we figure out what particular sentences, what particular spelling differences might underlie that? And how does that tell us about, you know, the mechanism, the wiring diagram, what's really wrong? We're trying to reverse engineer a system that took 3.5 billion years to evolve.
But, you know, we alluded to this. We're seeing perhaps there's a damaged gene that can go and cause damage in other cells and perhaps have something to do with causing cancer. But we're still not quite at that, what people thought was going to be the bingo moment. Why can't we just find those damaged genes and then attack them with something and we cure cancer?
Yeah, right. No, it sounds so great that the minute you read something for the first time, you know how to fix it. Oh, it's just nuts. It was nuts at the time. I think there was a lot of hype around the completion of the Human Genome Project. I think many of the scientists tried to avoid that hype. But this is the fundamental information that begins to tell us how cells work, how diseases work. The idea that that's going to translate into cures for everything in 10 years is crazy. What's really important is we're finding out what the root causes are. That's the foundation for really trying to fix things. If you were trying to fix your car and you weren't allowed to pop the hood and figure out what's wrong under the hood, you'd be shooting in the dark trying to figure out what to do. What we've done is we've been able to pop the hood. The real return on scientific revolutions is felt really over the course of 4 or 5 decades. I'll give you an example. In the late 1800s, people discovered that all these infectious diseases were caused by infectious organisms. Before that, they didn't know what caused infectious disease. Well, it took 70 years to go from the idea that there were bugs that made you sick to eventually having cheap antibiotics that made it the case that people in the developed world didn't die of infectious diseases so much. That was 70 years. But once that was done, that was a permanent change for everybody. We've got to look at those sort of returns. Now, I can give you great examples. There's a genome sequencing project that was done in England that led to the discovery that a particular gene, it goes by the funky name BRAF, it has mutations in about 50% of the people with skin cancer. Folks figured out how it worked. Some drug companies developed drugs that inhibited that, and they found a miraculous thing. Patients who had skin cancer lesions all over their body, those lesions completely, utterly disappeared.
Because they targeted the gene, the malfunctioning gene?
They targeted the malfunctioning gene, and they totally disappeared. And you'd say, that's miraculous. And it's miraculous. But there's a second part of the story. About 9 months later, they come back.
Right.
Targeting one thing, the cancer has some more tricks. The goal is to have a combination of 2 or 3 or 4 things that cut off all the escape paths for a cancer. That's going to be a world working together over the next couple of decades. And if that impact is truly felt for my children, when God forbid they might need it, I have no apologies that it might take several decades of the world working together to get us to the point that we have the total picture.
That's Eric Lander, founder of the Broad Institute, who today won the $3 million Breakthrough Prize in Life Sciences. He's also an advisor to the president on new science like mapping the brain. And he'll start teaching his Intro to Biology course free online through Harvard and MIT's edX starting March 5th. We'll have more at hereandnow.org. Meanwhile, when we come back, what about critics who say Eric's genetic research takes too much research money, is shutting other science out? We'll ask that in a minute, Here and Now. Welcome back to our conversation with Harvard and MIT's Eric Lander, one of the leaders of the Human Genome Project. He's also going to start teaching his MIT biology course free and online March 5th. His genetic research has unlocked the genetic drivers to diseases like cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's. But his critics say, where are the cures and what's been the cost? The research center he founded, the Broad Institute, has received well over $500 million in funding and employs 1,500 scientists. Other scientists have voiced concern that areas like, say, the role of bacteria, which may be as important as genes to our health, has missed out on funding. They want to map our body's bacteria, our microbiomes. And Eric says he's all for that.
The microbiome, of course, you're mapping using this gene sequencing technology. But let's actually put it in context. The whole Human Genome Project was about 1.5% of the budget of the National Institutes of Health. So we're talking about, is it worth, in our portfolio, spending 1.5% on getting that basic information freely available to everybody so tens of thousands of labs can be using it? Of course. To me, in a sense, it's like the roads and bridges. It's like encyclopedias and Wikipedias. everybody's going to use it. Some of our medical investment better go in producing information and tools for everybody. And then, of course, we've got to be supporting lots and lots of projects. It's not an either or.
What else in the work with genes? What are you envisioning?
Clearly, the most important reason we invest as a country in biomedical research is for human health. And there you see steady progress in all sorts of things. And I mentioned cancer. I could mention psychiatric diseases, where 5 years ago, the number of genes that we knew that were involved in a disease like schizophrenia was about zero. And today, it's about 72 genes that we know play a role, and they're beginning to fall together into a picture of what circuits, what processes to be focusing on. I think it'll lead to a revival of serious work on trying to treat psychiatric diseases with molecular medicines. That's all wonderful and important, and it'll take time, but in the long run, I think it'll be transformative. But there's also just pretty cool, amazing things that have nothing to do with medicine. One of the coolest, the past year or so, it's become clear that 4% of your genes, Robin, and mine, come from Neanderthals. I mean, like, that has no biomedical application, perhaps. Well, some people think it might even have some, but it is just so cool that we can now trace human history by the little genetic breadcrumbs that have been left in our DNA. We can understand the migrations around the world, how India was peopled and North America was peopled. It's an amazing window. You can understand evolution. You can understand ecology. It's as if biology has been keeping this amazing internet of information, all these web pages in DNA, and for the first time, we can read them and we can connect them.
Do you worry about, as some do, that all that information will lead to, for instance, genetic testing, and then people will not have, let's say, a child if the fetus has the genetics of, illness? I mean,
I always worry. I mean, scientists are first off people. I mean, I'm first off a dad, for example, of three kids. And, you know, I come at science first as just a person and as a citizen. Of course you have to worry. When you think about really powerful information that could be used to transform medicine and could also be misused, well, you want to be sure that you get the good uses. You don't want to stop it because that would be terrible because you wouldn't get the great advantages of it. But you want to be really clear that who's in charge of that information? It's got to be each patient is in charge of their own information and their own decisions. Each couple is in charge of what they would do with it. Information is powerful. It ought to be in your own control, including the right not to have that information. It's not up to somebody else to get that about you.
It's like an insurance company, for instance.
Well, it's not up to the insurance company to know. And in fact, we now have some laws that protect against that. But we got to be really clear that to get the benefit, we've got to make sure to protect the rights of individuals to be in control of their own information. Now, that said, I hope those individuals will choose in many cases to share that information. It would be so powerful if every cancer patient were to say, I voluntarily am willing to share the information that's learned from my own cancer so that we can aggregate information from tens of thousands of patients and accelerate the learning by 20-fold. But it's got to be a choice. And I hope we can make it secure enough that people can make that choice and feel good about that choice.
We mentioned you were an advisor to President Obama. What are you advising him?
The president has a pretty broad agenda. We've been working on advanced manufacturing, on our electromagnetic spectrum, on cybersecurity, drug innovation.
You mean like 3D manufacturing?
Well, 3D manufacturing and other cool things that are bringing manufacturing jobs back here. What sort of investments do we have to make to really unlock all that potential? Energy policy, climate. The flu. Our first task was when the H1N1 flu hit in 2009. The president gave us 6 weeks and said, please report back on what we can do about this. Most of all, the president really cares about science education, what we call STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math education. And we've done two full reports about it. And I think we've got to get a partnership between the professors in the universities who teach these things, and the 400,000 teachers of science and math in our middle schools and high schools, and then it goes beyond the schools. The whole model that you're supposed to learn in high school and learn for 4 years in college and then work, it's over.
Yeah.
Things change in our world so fast that learning is a lifelong thing, and we need to make ways for whenever you say, I wish I knew more about biology, you don't say it wistfully. You say, I'm going to clear out some time on my calendar. I'm just going to learn that. Someone came up to me at a conference once and said, I was moving from my day job in the computer industry to a job where I had to know a lot about biology, and I took this course online. Well, that turned out to be Bill Gates. That's how I met Bill Gates. Was Bill said, "Hi, I'm Bill Gates," which I actually knew. "I took your course." So you never know who you're going to impact, and it's going to be every stage of life. We got to get that right so everybody has access.
Well, I'm thinking that it's a matter of our health now to it be updated on biology. Eric Lander of the Broad Institute, nice to see you.
Great to talk to you. Open Gangnam
Style. Eric Lander, you spoke to us last week, by the way, before it was leaked this past week, and that he and other scientists were advising President Obama about that new project to map the human brain, which is why he did not tell us about it. It is, of course, modeled after his Human Genome Project. And by the way, Bill Gates, as we just heard, took an online course from Eric, but that wasn't fully open to the public. Eric Lander's new one is. It starts March 5th. We'll have links at our website. And while there, you can also see him dancing Gangnam Style. You're wondering why the Gangnam music? It's because it's Eric doing the dancing with MIT students. Those wacky MIT scientists. Latest news is next, here and now.